Morning. Morning to those watching online as well. Are we good, Steve? Good. There we go. Brilliant. Steve's doing both today for the first time. It's doing a good job. My name's Tabs, for those who don't know me. And I want to pose a scenario to you this morning. Now, before you get any ideas, this definitely is not something that has ever happened to me. Nor is it something that's happened to anyone I've ever known, and I can't imagine it ever would. But humour me for a moment. Imagine you wake up one day and you check your bank account. Maybe you're checking to see if your salary has gone in or your pension, or maybe you're checking to see that your Netflix subscription has gone out, or perhaps you're checking that you've got enough funds for your evening out for a cheeky Nando's later. But you open your banking account app, or you go to the old hole in the wall, and you notice something a bit odd. Someone would appear to have transferred you £10 million. Ka-ching! Oh, imagine that. What's your first thought? What would you do in that moment? What would you think? Do you think, oh, this is an amazing, I'm going to embrace this. I am a wonderfully kind person who's done this for us. I'm so amazingly blessed. And now my life has pretty much changed overnight. This is great. This is amazing. Tonight, the world will see more grilled chicken than it has ever known. Vegan alternatives, if you want, Mark. Are you the second person, the doubter, who instead of embracing this, you perhaps doubt the system? You think there must be some technical glitch here, or perhaps you doubt the intentions of the sender. Did they do this by accident? Because people might have done that by accident. Or maybe even something dodgy is going on, and now you're involved in some global illegal hustle, and you've got a mark next to your name. Or thirdly, do you completely disbelieve it altogether and tell yourself that you're just imagining it and choose to ignore that the money's even there and just go on about your life and somehow forget about it? Do you embrace the amazing gift? Do you doubt its legitimacy and seek to investigate what on earth has happened? Or do you deny any existence and go on with your life? I think most of us would be doubters, right? I think. We'd at least want to check out what's happened rather than blindly believing we can head out on a shopping spree. Or maybe that's just me. So why then? Why then? That when we read these accounts of the resurrected Jesus appearing alive again, something way more amazing, way more unbelievably incredible than just getting a few million in your bank account. When we read these accounts of the resurrected Jesus appearing alive again, we brand Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, as Doubting Thomas. Doubting Thomas, this is the odd one out that we look down on, and for not having enough faith, for asking questions, for wanting more to go off. Instead, the more I think about this, the more I'm pretty certain that I'd have had the same response as Thomas. Of, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. And I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one. I know it's not a comfortable idea, but I'm pretty sure I would be a doubter in that room. I'd be a skeptic. I'd want to know that this really checks out. The philosopher Jimmy Carter Smith says this about doubt and skepticism in today's world. He says, do not equate a secular society with a society of unbelief. Instead, a secular society is one in which we all experience the contestability of our belief. What it feels like to inhabit a society in which on your street you know there are people who don't believe what you believe. And they're good people, they're smart people. And you realise that what you believe can't be taken to be axiomatic and the default of our society anymore. Everybody in this secular age is going to experience what Charles Taylor, another philosopher, calls cross-pressure. In our secular age, very different to, let's say, 1500 AD, where having faith was the default of society. We're going to feel tugged and pulled and pressured by alternative rival stories of who we are and what we're here for. He says, we're all Thomas now. How many of you have ever had a moment, just a moment perhaps, when the thought came to your mind to ask, am I crazy? Not just me, thank you. That's a huge relief. Oh, I mean, the 915, I don't think any of them thought they were crazy, but you guys can see it. Am I crazy? Is any of this real? God, Jesus, the scriptures, like, am I just making this up in my head? Have you ever stopped and thought for a moment, maybe that this is just all some mass delusion or something? John Mark Comer poses this exact question in his teaching on doubt and the widely spreading phenomenon in the Western church, particularly in my generation, of faith deconstruction. He says, in spite of all that God has done in your life, in spite of story after story of answered prayer and a coincidence for which there is no other rational explanation other than God, or a prophetic word spoken over you, or a sense of God's spirit with you in your mind and in your body, not to mention the billions of other followers of Jesus who have this similar experience. Despite all of that experience, have you ever stopped and thought, just for that moment, have you ever doubted? And has that moment ever turned into a day? And has that day ever turned into a week? And has that week ever turned into a month, into a season of your life when you, with your faith, a calm, settled assurance of reality is called into question? If so, you are not alone, John says. You are shoulder to shoulder with all sorts of people, more than you think. Personally, I don't know about you, but I've definitely had my fair share of shaky moments in my faith. I've never had a sort of significant season of doubt necessarily, but being a millennial, I have followed the journeys of many fellow Christians who have hit a season of life very much filled with doubt, where they have, what we say, deconstructed their whole faith outlook. There's countless blogs on the internet of telling in-depth philosophical stories of followers of Jesus who have deconstructed their faith and walked away from the church. Loads of these stories seem to follow very similar patterns, almost like they're copying some sort of template they've found. But the faith deconstruction story we are going to look at today, and we've begun to look at today, is the journey of Thomas, one of the 12. And there's three stages to Thomas's journey outlined in A.J. Swoboda's book, After Doubt, How to Question Your Faith Without Losing It. And hopefully by identifying these three stages of Thomas, we're going to actually have some help to understand how we can walk through doubt and deconstruction. But maybe more relevant for others, it might be that perhaps we can be better placed to walk with others when they are going through that. Firstly, there is, how is faith constructed? Thomas had believed in Jesus before. He'd constructed his faith. He'd spent 3 years following Jesus. He'd seen miracles. He'd seen multiplication of fish. He'd had all these incredible moments. He'd believed because of all the things that he'd seen. And in our own journey, this construction phase, if you like, I gave up civil engineering 11 years ago, so I'm not going to push the illustration too far. But this construction phase, like Thomas, we went through where we began to believe in Jesus. This is the stage where we begin to construct our beliefs about God. I first met Jesus when I was 15, whilst reading a book that I'd got from my parents' church at home. I'm incredibly grateful to my parents and to those who helped me to construct my faith. They taught me how to read the Bible. They taught me how to serve, how to give of myself to the kingdom. They taught me all sorts of really important stuff about my early Christian faith. I was handed down deep core beliefs, and I received them. I didn't question them so much. I just received them as they were, on the most part. The second stage to Thomas's faith journey is his deconstruction. Thomas's faith is shattered by a disappointment of Jesus' death. This Jesus, who he'd followed around the Middle East for 3 years, the promised Messiah, fulfilling all sorts of Jewish prophecies, who was going to redeem Israel at Passover time and take back control from the Romans. But in the week leading up to Jesus' death, the Jews start to notice something isn't right. That this Jesus doesn't match up with their expectations. He's riding in on a donkey. He's washing people's feet, which is just gross. A servant's job. He's weeping over the city. He's serving the poor. He's not fighting back. He's not arguing in court. He's not picking up arms. He's not inciting others to pick up arms. And then he's brutally put to death on a cross. Safe to say that Thomas's faith in Jesus would have been shattered by the disappointment of Jesus' death. Edward Norbeck, who's a sociologist of culture, coined a term which I'm going to teach us all today. It's the term ethnocentrism. Everyone say ethnocentrism. Ethnocentrism. Well done. It literally means to be people-centered, okay? It's the idea that your culture and your moment in time is the most important and the best. Nothing can be what you know. You are the centre of all things. You centre all your trust on your own understanding, your own worldview, ethnocentrism, to believe in yourself above all else. Do you hear the ethnocentrism in Thomas's voice? If I can touch his side, then I will believe. When faced with doubt, when deconstructing the things he believed about this man Jesus, Thomas has fallen into the classic trap. Instead of believing that God made humanity in God's image, Thomas has made God in humanity's image. Thomas is saying, this is who I expect the Son of God to be. But now he's dead, and that doesn't add up to my image of who he was meant to be. We live in a time in the Western church where followers of Jesus, even some very prominent Christian leaders, are finding their faith shattered by hurt. Hurt from broken vision of the beliefs they'd constructed, hurt from stories of abuse coming out in the church, hurt from moral failures, huge betrayals. Several of us in our community here at Christchurch have been very close to the Soul Survivor youth movement, myself possibly more than a lot, but if you're not aware of that, generations of Christians, young Christians in their thousands, came to faith through incredible experiences of God, through annual Soul Survivor festivals, many of whom have now been thrust into a painful process of deconstructing the faith they had received after hundreds of substantiated claims of abuse have come to be made public. There's so much I could say on that. But we need to be, the one thing I will say, that we need to be careful. We need to be careful to see the difference between deconstructing our faith in Jesus and deconstructing our faith in religion gone bad. We've confused bad religion with Jesus. Eugene Peterson, in one of his books, says there's all kinds of diseases that you can get. He says one of the problems, if you go to the hospital to get treated for sickness, is that when you go to hospital, there's other sick people in there too. There's a apparently there's a unique kind of illness that they call iatrogenic diseases, which are diseases that you pick up from hospitals. And the truth of the matter is, every single person in this room, if they've received Jesus, was handed the gospel, was handed a faith in Jesus by an imperfect community. And at some point in our journey, we begin to wake up to the idea that some of the things that we were handed weren't actually right, weren't good even. A wise person once told me to eat the meat and spit out the bones. That's how I learned to eat fish as a child. I actually think a lot of us, we need to receive the good and let go of the bad. So deconstruction can actually be a really faithful way of following Jesus when it's done with the right heart. We actually need to be asking big questions. Alpha is such a great opportunity for that. Whatever stage of your walk you're in, because perhaps things we've been handed aren't good. People play off doubt and belief like they're opposites. Unbelief is the opposite of belief, and that's not the same as doubt. Unbelief is a straightforward no. Like if you were to tell me that they discovered coffee was the main substance that caused some kind of lifelong chronic illness and everyone should immediately stop drinking it, my fingers would go straight in my ears and I'd be like, no, 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 I refuse to believe that for 1 second. No way, I don't want to believe that. Whereas doubt is different. Doubt is a middle ground, almost. Doubt can go either way. We can end up believing our doubts or disbelieving our doubts. The key thing, hear this, is what is our end goal? Is our end goal a desire to believe more closely and to grow more closer to Jesus? If so, do we stick at it? Do we persevere? Do we keep showing up like Thomas? Which brings us on to our third stage in Thomas's faith journey, where he encounters the risen Jesus and believes. If you're anything like me, many of you were never taught that doubt can be a legitimate space to actually encounter the living God. And so what often happens is when we encounter doubt, we feel a bit guilty about it, perhaps. We enter into these moments where we question what we think about God, and all of a sudden we start wondering, do I even love Jesus? How could I doubt? What must he think of me? But for Thomas, doubt isn't a bad thing, provided the end goal of his doubt was to desire to believe. Because in this place that his encounter happens, his encounter with Jesus, the Son of God, who rose from the dead, all of his expectations and his assumptions thrown out the window because he still showed up. He didn't give up on his faith. He didn't walk away and desert the community of disciples. When people come across doubts these days, what often happens is rather than walking through it in the presence of Jesus, they walk away. When we hear a Christian brother or sister going through a faith struggle, our first thing is to want to say something to fix it. Like, watch this YouTube video, or read about this apologist, or get a load of this sermon, and everything will be fine. Everything will be fine. But actually, at that moment in time, that person questioning isn't looking for someone to offer them all the answers. They're not looking for a link to a webpage. They're looking for someone to walk with them. They are yearning to be seen. I believe the enemy's main tactic when someone is doubting is to separate them from the community of believers. We see it time and time again. How can we choose to instead follow the example of the disciples who say, "Hey, Thomas, we know you're struggling. We know you're doubting, but we want to stick with you. Keep showing up. We want to journey with you. Don't slide out the back door. This is where you belong, no matter what your struggles are. Because none of us are perfect. We are an imperfect community. So join us as we seek the risen Jesus, who lives for the doubters, who lives for you and for me. Let's encounter him together." Thomas gets to touch the wounds of the risen Jesus. His doubts become this legitimate space for encountering Jesus, and he worships him there. "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." What a blessing it is to have the faith, to trust in the risen Jesus. May we forever be grateful for this life-changing gift.